We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Back beginning in the late 1940s, the University of Illinois became the first university to provide a support system for students with disabilities and established what is today the Division of Disability Resources and Educational Services. This morning in this hour of the show, what we want to try to do is talk a little bit about that history, about the continuing challenge that the division is trying to meet in terms of providing access to students who have a variety of disabilities. And we'll also talk a little bit about a program that aims at helping people by providing them equipment and training who want to be athletes, people from outside of the United States. And we have two guests here with us this morning. Brad Hedrick, he is director of the Division of Disability Resources and Education Services here at the U of I. He's had that job for 10 years.
Right? Well, 15. More than
that? Oh, 15 years. Oh, you need to update your
bio.
Time
flies when you're having fun.
There we go. And he has a lot of experience in the field of rehabilitation. He's also coached athletes with disabilities at the local, the national, international levels. He's done a lot of writing also on the subject. He is a member of the National Wheelchair Basketball Association Hall of Fame and the National Intercollegiate Wheelchair Basketball Hall of Fame. Also here in studio with us is Jean Driscoll. She's the Associate Director of Development and Alumni Relations in the College of Applied Health Sciences and very well known as an athlete. She won the women's wheelchair division of the Boston Marathon 8 times. That is more than any other woman athlete in that division. She also has participated in 4 summer Paralympic Games. She won a total of 5 gold, 3 silver, 4 bronze medals. We're pleased to have both of them here in the studio to talk. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you can email us as well, will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it.
Our pleasure.
My pleasure.
There is a quite a long history here at this university, which has made it, I think, the leader anywhere in providing educational opportunities to students with a variety of disabilities. And I guess really before you do anything else, the guy that we have to acknowledge here is Tim Nugent, who at the time that I talked about here, really going back to the years right after World War II, was a pioneer in this field. And if not for him being here, you all probably wouldn't, maybe you all wouldn't be here either. Talk about Tim Nugent.
Tim obviously was an amazing visionary. He had he perceived a future for individuals with disabilities that was antithetical to socially held stereotypical beliefs about disability. But uniqueness of vision was just one facet of that. That Tim had the passion to resist the forces of society that resisted his vision, and that he was able to persist ultimately to the point of winning out, and in winning out, really changed the course of the river for people with disabilities in terms of their ability to participate in all aspects of society, and in making post-secondary education available to persons with disabilities. Though there's certainly no panacea for disability, education is as close as we have, and as being a great equalizer. And the fact that post-secondary education is widely available today, that we have laws that promote and provide for that, are all seeded here from the seminal work that Tim did in 1948 and on until he retired in developing strategies for the accommodation of people with disabilities, and both in public accommodations long before the ADA even came up with the construct of the public accommodation, and in educational settings. And he was just an extraordinary sort of entrepreneurial kind of guy in this area.
Mm. And was the university open to all of this, or was this another of the kind of struggles he had to deal with, was the university not totally being receptive to the idea?
Well, the university doesn't exist in a vacuum. That the faculty, the administrators, the individuals who were present on the campus were apparently as likely to hold the beliefs that people with disabilities were incapable of pursuing degrees at Illinois, and most certainly if they were somehow miraculously able to earn them, would not be able to function in an employment situation and have a career. And so, there was a considerable amount of resistance. It was unknown what will the cost, what would, you know, the impact of this be on the mission of the campus, and we perceive no value. And he was fighting against the currents there as well. And actually, the program, when it first was developed, it was opened at the University of Illinois Galesburg, which was formerly a VA hospital. It was converted to a campus of the university to deal with the large numbers of veterans returning from the Second World War with GI funding, there were simply not enough classrooms to deal with that. And so they created a satellite. And because it was a former VA hospital, it was accessible. And so they incorporated these veterans with disabilities. But then they closed the campus at the end of that first year. And Tim approached Illinois and actually somewhere between 300 or 400 other schools, all of which unanimously declined the opportunity to host the program that began at Galesburg. And it was only through, we say, the first act of peaceful civil disobedience by students, persons with disabilities, on behalf of their own civil rights and access to education. They drove a caravan of former students students from Galesburg to Springfield. They lobbied first for Galesburg to be reopened. And though there was apparently no support for that, the effort ultimately was embarrassing enough, I think, at that time to the legislature and to the governor that they struck a deal with the campus that, you know, I laugh and often say it was probably one of those deals that if you will remove this problem from our doorstep, we'll be sure you get a budget, which at that time was a much higher percentage of their operating capital here. So it was really that kind of a context in which Tim was able to get seated. But then for the first, I believe, 7 years of the program here, he operated without state funding. Again, that was part of that entrepreneurial activity for which he became well known, was in sort of band-aiding together, the patching together the funding that was needed to build and sustain that program in its early years.
Yeah, and I gather that he did whatever needed to be done, including personally building wheelchair ramps so that people who use wheelchairs could actually get into the buildings?
Sure. They would often go out at night and build. They'd get the student schedules. They'd go out at night. They would build ramps. They would organize till midnight the caravans of cars, the people, the individuals, the veterans who had cars. They would pull all the schedules together and decide who was going to ride with whom to get to class, and they were doing that on a daily basis, triaging the schedules to make sure everyone got to the classes and that ramps were available in the buildings and that the classes got moved to those buildings that had ramps. So they were constantly putting out fires, I think, in the first few years in executing the mission of getting the students into class.
Well, and one of my favorite stories about Tim Nugent is the professors who wouldn't move their classes from an upper floor down to a main level floor because there were no elevators at that time, they got a personal visit from Tim, and we were told he had red hair and a temper to match. So he got a lot done.
Well, by the time, Gene, you came here to the University of Illinois, it was a little bit past these formative, early formative years.
It was a lot past.
Okay, so it was a lot past. And I know that you said that it was Brad who was involved in recruiting you to come
Yes,
here,
that's
right?
correct. Uh-huh.
So what when you were in high school and you were thinking about what you were going to do from there, what were you thinking about, and what sort of opportunities would there have been then for you to go to college?
I grew up in Milwaukee, and I started using a wheelchair when I was 15, and had a lot of the same ideas that many people do. I thought it was going to limit me, and I wasn't really dreaming too big at that time. And after I graduated from high school, I did start attending the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and it was during that time that I met Brad. I had found out about wheelchair sports in Milwaukee, and there was a workshop that was being held in Milwaukee, and Brad and his wife Sharon were supposed to come up and speak. Sharon wasn't feeling well, so Brad did all the speaking. And then I was playing in an exhibition game of wheelchair soccer, and I caught Brad's eye. And he came up and started giving me the whole spiel. How would you like to be a member of the University of Illinois women's wheelchair basketball team? And I listened politely, but being from Wisconsin, there was no way I was going to Illinois. No way. I had taken some time off of school and was working as a live-in mother's helper, and he kept calling and sending me letters. Having grown up with my disability, I was always the last kid picked for a team, whether it was on the playground or during physical education classes, and the fact that somebody wanted me on their team made a huge difference to me. And so I thought, okay, I'll go to Illinois and I'll finish my degree, but then I'm hightailing it back to Wisconsin. And that was in 1987, and I haven't been back.
I think it's one of the things that's really, again, noteworthy, and I guess this is, again, the credit goes to Tim, is that he had a very strong feeling that for people who were going to come here to the university, yeah, we're going to come here for an education, yes, but that they ought to be able to participate in other activities as well. And for him, athletics was a big thing. But I also understand that early on there were some people who weren't real sure about this, and even the university wasn't real sure about it, and whether or not that would be seen as exploiting those students, whether some people apparently thought, well, that was about Tim promoting himself, or it was about raising money, or, you know, whatever it was. There was so much concern in the university, apparently, that early on the university didn't even want the name of the university on the team.
Right. Yeah, another one of those sort of circumstances where we were so blinded by bigotry we couldn't see the obvious, that Tim was really first and foremost concerned that students with disabilities would have equitable access to all of the curricular and extracurricular types of programs that their peers without disabilities had access to, that really normalizing that experience. And certainly sport has always been and continues today, unarguably, to be a major extracurricular activity of interest in a college environment. And so he saw it first as just normalizing their experience. Secondly, he saw it as critical because these were individuals that did have substantial disabilities, and realizing that the one thing that was going to compromise their participation in society, their ability to have sustained and successful careers and families and productive and enjoyable lives was going to be their health. And that it was critical that they get ahead of that early on, that they develop skills and interest and knowledge in physical activity and things that they could perpetuate their involvement in for the rest of their lives to a great extent, and maintain that health. But lastly, Tim really did see sport. He would often describe it as a great common denominator that. He would say it would be impossible to go out and give enough lectures on disability to fully inform the general public about every condition and all of the manifestations of those conditions and how they really impact the life of an individual. But he would say in 40 minutes of a wheelchair basketball exhibition, you can substantially and abruptly change the stereotypical beliefs about disability of a fairly large population of people that are there to watch. And And he often had exhibitions and would and get the local celebrities, fire department, police department in wheelchairs, and they would play games against the Illinois team. And that, he did that as a fundraiser. Yes, they were trying to raise the money necessary to fund the program. But interestingly, they would often start out very patronizing. And sort of condescending in their engagement with them of, well, these are folks with disabilities. But somewhere along the line, after you spotted them 70 points and they hadn't scored a basket and hadn't moved the ball to half court and they were being brutalized by these guys in wheelchairs who had already made up the 70-point differential and were now saying, let's give them 20 more, all of a sudden, the egos of those competitors would come out, and they'd realize, you know, these individuals are not fragile; they're actually quite extraordinarily gifted in athletics, and then they really learned a lot to respect the ability of a person with an impairment rather than focus exclusively on that impairment and the limitation, and then Tim would say, when those folks go back into the employment situation, they're going to have a wholly different perception of what the abilities of the person in a wheelchair that comes into their office and asks for a job. They're going to have a different look at that person. They're going to perceive a capacity they may not have perceived before that exhibition. So he saw it as really critical also to the sort of social acceptance of people with impairments.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gene, you having had the opportunity to come to the University of Illinois to develop your athletic ability and to compete at a very high, very high level, you think did that change the direction that your life ended up taking?
The University of Illinois changed my life. The opportunities that exist here at the University of Illinois changed my life. And I still, over 20 years later, tear up very easily when I think about that. There were, you know, Tim Nugent laid such an incredible groundwork of opportunity here, and it seemed like everybody who then came here to study with him, to be a graduate assistant, to be an actual wheelchair athlete, a lot of people went on to do great things, and so I'm just one story in a list of stories that would take the whole day to tell, if we had the time. So absolutely, this place has changed my life.
Our guests this morning in the studio include Jean Driscoll. She is a graduate of University of Illinois. She is now the Associate Director of Development and Alumni Relations in the College of Applied Health Sciences, an 8-time champion of the Boston Marathon, won a few medals in the Olympics as well. Also here in studio is Brad Hedrick. He is Director of the Division of Disability Resources and Education Services here at the University of Illinois. 15 years in the job?
In one variation or another of that job, yes. Right.
And he's done a little wheelchair basketball, a little racing himself. Maybe not quite at Gene's level, but you did.
I certainly would not pretend to have been successful at Gene's level, but... That was actually what brought me to Illinois. As having post polio, I was never able to. I always had a great enthusiasm for and interest in sport, but never really had an opportunity to participate. And I was while I was a college student at North Carolina, I was introduced to wheelchair basketball, and I went on and graduated and continued to enjoy basketball and went to work for Voc Rehab in the state of North Carolina. And I posed to my supervisor one day that it seemed to me we were doing an extraordinary job of training people at that time with developmental disabilities for work, but they were losing their jobs because they didn't manage their leisure time. And he said, well, that's not our mission. And I said, well, you know, our mission is to employ them. If we're failing on this, we need to consider this. That was one of those moments where I realized the importance of leisure and sort of on my own without Tim's input, triangulated on the importance of leisure in rehabilitation. And went back to North Carolina to pursue a degree, and the faculty at North Carolina said, given your interest, there's only one place in the world for you to go to school, and you have to go pursue a doctorate at Illinois. So the faculty at North Carolina basically spent 2 years conditioning me to accept the fact that I would have to come to Illinois and do an apprenticeship, a graduate assistantship for Tim and the rehab center and pursue a doctorate here. And so that's really how I ended up here.
Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talkkit to illinois.edu. Well, there are a number of things I'd like to talk about. Maybe here I'll shift a little bit because I want to make sure that we take time to talk about this project that Gene was involved in with working with some folks from Ghana in West Africa. To provide both equipment and actually bring people here to the University of Illinois for training to be able to develop their athletic skills. How did this whole thing get started?
Well, my last competitive event was the 2000 Sydney Paralympic Games. And while I was in Sydney, I met a woman named Johnny Erickson Tada, who is a very well-known, high-profile Christian woman with a high-level quadriplegia, and she's got this organization called Johnny and Friends. And one of the programs within her organization is called Wheels for the World. It's a program through which wheelchairs are collected across the country, sent to one of 20 prisons where inmates restore the wheelchairs to leg-new condition, and then the wheelchairs are distributed in countries where they're scarce commodities. There are a lot of places where people are being pushed around in wheelbarrows or stuck in a back room their entire lives. So there's a great need for these wheelchairs to be distributed in other countries. Well, after I announced my retirement following Sydney, I got a phone call from somebody in Johnny's office, and they asked if I would go to Ghana, West Africa to teach a wheelchair track camp. And one of the things when you are an athlete in the wheelchair sports program at the University of Illinois, you are involved in helping teach wheelchair basketball camps, wheelchair track camps. It's not a free ride. You are taught to give back and pay forward. And so I had taught a lot of basketball and track camps at that point. And I have to be honest, though, Ghana was not on my top 100 list of places to visit, and so I politely turned them down. And then they called back a couple months later, and I politely turned them down. And then a third time they called, and I said, "Okay, I'll go and I'll teach this wheelchair track camp." And so I flew over in August of 2001, and I knew that polio was still endemic there. I expected people would be limping into the stadium. Perhaps some of them would be on crutches or even will have been beneficiaries of wheelchair distributions. But what I wasn't prepared for were the people who crawled into the stadium on their hands and knees, and they were wearing sandals on their hands, and they had calluses on their knees like you have on the bottom of your feet. And they had crawled 2 to 3 blocks from their hostel to get to the stadium for the workout, the morning workout. And we were doing morning and afternoon workouts. And I just sat there and stared at these people crawling in, and immediately flashed back to when I was 15 and a bunch of failed surgeries required my initial use of a wheelchair. And I didn't want to touch it for weeks. And yet I've never had the indignity of crawling on the ground. Even if I were to crawl around in the studio, it would be cleaner and more dignified than how these people crawl in their villages and in their home country. And I had donated equipment, and for some of them, for 10 minutes in the morning and 10 minutes in the evening, it was their only opportunity to be up off the ground. That stuck with me. So I went back in 2002, taught another camp. In 2003, worked with Rotary and raised a bunch of money. There were 5 local Rotary clubs, that Urbana, Savoy, Champaign, that got involved and helped raise money. And Rotary International provided a matching funds grant. And so we raised $60,000 and brought 8 of those people with disabilities here to the U.S., along with 2 non-disabled coaches to help teach them. And we got them their first ever everyday wheelchairs and their first ever racing chairs. And the athletes received these wheelchairs at a Rotary Club luncheon. And one of them sat down in his wheelchair and he said, "I'm so happy I could laugh." It was the best imagery. And then in 2004, for the first time in history, Ghana sent 1 male and 1 female to the Paralympic Games in Athens. They had never sent anybody before except for a non-disabled representative who attended all the meetings. But they never saw the importance or the value in sending somebody with a disability to, well, first of all, to invest in their ability to train and develop into athletes, but then to pay for them to go to an event. So the biggest thing out of that was the young girl that got to go was a young lady that got to come here to the U.S., and she was interviewed through an interpreter. You know, how has this changed your life? She was in fourth grade when she got polio. Immediately, her life was over. No longer valued. No more education. Her family all but disowned her. She would eat, you know, where the dogs ate, separate from the family. And so she's asked, how has coming to the U.S. and now representing your country in the Paralympics changed your life? And she said, now my family talks to me. And so in 2007, five athletes came back over here, and President Joe White and the dean of the College of Applied Health Sciences, Tanya Gallagher, along with Tim Nugent, we all had lunch in the president's office with white tablecloths, and they had gifts for President White and Dean Gallagher and Tim Nugent. And after that, Dean Gallagher said, you know, I think that we can expand what you're doing. And so the International Disability Sport Outreach Program was created as a service unit of our college's, well, actually, it's the Campus Center on Health, Aging, and Disability. It's an interdisciplinary center that focuses on wellness, healthy aging, aging with a disability. And so now this International Disability Sport Outreach Program is a service unit of that. And we're hoping to replicate what's been done in Ghana to other countries once we're able to get more funding to sustain it.
Well, obviously, you've set up a kind of a model that shows how you can do it and that you can do it. And I'm sure that there must be tremendous need all over the world, people in the same kind of circumstances that these folks were in Ghana.
There is a tremendous need all over the world, and people aren't just crawling on the ground in African nations. They're doing it in the Middle East. They're doing it in Asian nations. You know, there's thousands of years of tribal suspicions and beliefs. Brad talked about some of the social beliefs even back around World War II here in the United States. You can go back even further in time, and those are the beliefs and the social mores that are still held in these other countries. So it's a pretty dismal life for people with disabilities, but just like music, sport is an international language, and it's a wonderful way to show people that that they can be strength and they are able and they do have value.
Our guests here in this hour of Focus, Gene Driscoll and Brad Hedrick. Gene is Associate Director of Development and Alumni Relations in the College of Applied Health Sciences and an accomplished and internationally recognized athlete. Brad is the Director of the Division of Disability Resources and Education Services at University of Illinois. And we're talking some about the approach here that the university has taken over some time to try to serve students with disabilities. And questions, comments, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, right now at the University of Illinois, how many, if you have asked this question, well, students with disabilities who are here at university, can you actually put a number on that?
Well, we can't put a definitive number because not every student with a disability now registers with our unit for service. There's the numbers of students with mobility disabilities have remained pretty stable since the Tim's directorship. Mm-hmm. But the total numbers served by our unit have changed dramatically, particularly over the last 20 years, with the increasing numbers of students with learning disabilities, with attention deficit, with psychiatric disabilities, increasing numbers with traumatic brain injury. And so our unit now, which in historically was serving about 200 to 250 students, we now have about 1,100 students registered annually for support services through the division.
That's, I think this makes the important point that you, perhaps that as far as the university is concerned and the population you try to serve, it's a fairly expansive definition of disability, and that people, and perhaps it's because of the high profile of wheelchair sports at the university, I'm sure that people think disabled student, okay, they think of somebody who has mobility disability, so maybe somebody uses a wheelchair. Maybe you prod them a little bit, they think about sensory disability. So, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, I guess there are people who are blind, right, yeah. But that there's another population, and it's maybe a little less obvious. That may, in fact, be people who aren't, for a variety of reasons, going to identify that they have disabilities, right. That could benefit by a range of services, and I saw the talk that you gave some time back that got me thinking about this a little bit differently. But any university, they're concerned once they'd like to get people there in school, and once they're in school, they'd like them to finish and get their degrees. So people spend a lot of time thinking about, well, what happens to students along the line that they leave? You know, what exactly is going on? So to what extent do you think that unaddressed or unserved disabilities ends up being a big reason why some students don't make it all the way through and finish their degrees?
Well, we really don't have a metric for the extent to which that's absolutely occurring. But we did hear, actually, that's when one of our more recent innovations in service was when I started around 95 in one of my early phases of directorship, we had very low instance of students with cognitive or psychiatric disability. We had actually no students with psychiatric disability, yet this is a college age is where age of onset of psychiatric impairment really spikes. And starts. And so we knew that the onset of impairment corresponded to college enrollment, and yet our incidence was very low. And so we hypothesized that we were potentially underserving or not serving a population of students who would, as a result, be at risk of not being retained or not performing up to their capabilities. And so We started a pilot program with the Counseling Center and McKinley Mental Health, and we said if any of the students who come in who have extraordinarily poor academic histories, who are at risk of being dropped by the university or who have periodically been dropped and readmitted, who come into those venues requesting aid, we developed an intervention so that the Counseling Center and McKinley Mental Health would do a screening, a multi-hour screening, to basically rule out that, well, you still don't study very well, or the 1 hour of studying and 10 hours of partying model is not working. But they would basically rule these things out and say, you know, we cannot rule out the possibility of an impairment of a disability, and then recommend that they seek testing, and some could come to our unit. We developed free testing protocols because we didn't want students demurring there because the cost could be prohibitive, $3,000 to get a comprehensive assessment. And so we provided testing. We've done that now for about 10 years. We've identified out of a little over 1,000 students, about 600 students who actually did have undiagnosed and unaccommodated conditions. And those students who were very unlikely to have been retained and graduated have those that have been identified and served have all graduated if they've been here long enough to do so. Their GPAs have significantly increased, and they're doing extraordinarily well through that intervention. And I think that's the same kind of approach Tim used in serving mobility, but having to ask some fundamental questions about what are the barriers for this population that may not have existed prior that we need to be addressed if we're going to give students with these impairments comparable access to the opportunities that this campus provides its students.
Yeah. I was just to shift just a little bit. I'm interested in talking some more about accessibility and maybe you know, Gene could talk about it, and you both could talk about it, and your experiences over time. I guess I'm just finding myself going back to the idea that in the middle of the night that you'd have to go out and build wheelchair ramps, or that you'd have to arm wrestle with professors whose classes were on the second floor and there was no elevator to get them to move down, you know. So maybe we got past that point, but are there, with as much as has been done, are there still on this campus serious accessibility issues?
Brad, I think you could speak to that.
Actually, this campus is from an architectural standpoint is extraordinary, and even still has many amenities here for access that are not even part of the code. These bipedal auto operators on doors, so that students who don't have the range of motion or strength or control of an upper extremity sufficient to press on one of these panel buttons that we'll see oftentimes on the buildings, we've located them also about 8 inches off the ground so that they could bump it with the foot plates of a wheelchair to gain access. Those are not elements of the code. We did get decades of running start on architectural access here because Tim was nailing up ramps before any other campus, really in response to really more mostly to the ADA, though there was a need in the late 70s for them to respond to the Rehab Act in providing access. But most campuses really didn't ramp that up until ADA said you better do a self-assessment and get a handle on your access problems. And this university has always been very proactive about not even saying what it, you know, what's the code, what's the minimum, but what are the needs that have to be met. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons for that is we do have such a large population of students with the most severe level of physical impairment that I know one of the projects that I think at the presentation we talked about was a wireless elevator control system.
Yeah.
And another example of looking at the problem, not at the code, but the problem is you can have an elevator that meets the code that a student with a severe disability can't operate. So they still require a surrogate if they're going to call the elevator or push the panel buttons to the floor of their destination or to use the emergency phone if the elevator weren't working. And so working with faculty here, Dan Mastin Engineering, to create a device that could be installed in the elevators that would allow the students to independently call those elevators and operate those systems without assistance. You know, that's really just an extension of Tim's work of saying, here's, you know, we expand no matter how wide we make the net or the opportunity for access, we always create a new marginalized group. And I think one thing I learned here in working with Tim is you can't be satisfied. You've done a wonderful job of serving the core and expanding the core. But ultimately, no matter what success you've had, you've created a new group who's at the margin, who with just some new intervention, some new service, a new technology, or a new strategy, you're going to bring them into this and afford them the same level of opportunity that those who are inside that sort of bubble of support and access have. And we continually try to apply that in Dres and build on that.
Yeah,
and the wireless elevator is the current example.
That was something that really struck me in watching this talk that you gave, is that as you continue to push the envelope, I don't know what kind of sad metaphor I'm going to reach for. You know, if you can continue to push the door open, somebody's going to come along and say, "No, come on, push it some more."
Right.
And that the more you try to broaden the opportunity, the more that you try to broaden access, and you kind of think, "Okay, well, we've done it." Then somebody else is going to come along with another kind of need. You're going to say, "Well, we need to work on this thing." So it seems like it's a constantly expanding sort of field.
Yeah, actually, accessibility is not a goal. It's not a destination. It's a process that we are constantly looking to refine the amenities that make venues accessible or the processes that make programs accessible. In online curriculum, for instance, we say in the virtual world, we in many respects have spent years sort of reforming the concrete that Tim spent decades trying to ramp. And so accessibility now, in many respects, has moved into this world of the internet and online education and those resources. And are those available and accessible and usable for individuals with disabilities? And that's another major thrust of the division's work, to look systemically at how those contexts need to change so that we don't sort of recreate the inaccessibility that we had for so many decades in the built environment.
Yeah. I'd like to add to what Brad just said, though. While accessibility is being expanded greater and greater, it also is benefiting and impacting a greater and greater population. Things that were developed for you know, quote unquote, people with disabilities are actually things that everybody enjoys. For example, curb cuts. The University of Illinois was the first university campus to have curb cuts. And Tim Nugent went to the campus, he went to the city, nobody would ramp the curbs. And so he got out there on his own and broke up the curb and ramped the curb back in the early 50s. As Brad was talking about collaboration with engineering, Tim was doing that back in the 50s as well, in trying to expand accessibility. But when you think about a curb cut, somebody in a wheelchair is not the only person using that curb cut. There are moms with strollers. There are kids on skateboards, you know, people on bikes. A lot of people don't even step off curbs anymore. I can't tell you how many times I have been going to a meeting around campus and somebody, it might just be one person, standing in the middle of the curb cut waiting for the light to change. And I have to say, excuse me, could I use that? But these technologies that are being developed, there's a phrase called universal design. It's actually has universal benefits, even though its initial design may be to benefit somebody with an obvious disability. Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things that I'm just really curious about is now here, you, both of you, work at a university has set a very high standard for accessibility, and we have communities where at least there ought to be a fairly high level of awareness on the issue. Well, when you go outside of Champaign-Urbana, what's your experience is?
Well, here in the U.S., actually, it's pretty good. When you start traveling internationally, that's when it's extremely noticeable how the advances and the laws that exist here in the U.S. are not universal around the world, and it can be challenging when you're traveling in places where there's only stairs. I was 20 years ago. I went to a track meet in Japan, and we were trying to get down to the subway, and there were about 25 stairs to get down to the subway, and there were about 7 guys trying to carry me down those stairs, and I was being jostled forward, backward, side to side. It was kind of scary, and I've had friends who have been to Japan since then, and it's much more accessible now, and they, you know, have the elevators or the lifts like we do here. But then I go to Africa. Or any of those Mediterranean countries, and you still have to get pulled upstairs.
Are there other countries that do, though, have something that would be the equivalent of the Americans with Disabilities Act? That is, as a matter of national policy, they say accessibility is important and it's the law, and the built environment is going to have to be altered accordingly?
Well, I mean, civil rights for persons with disabilities are becoming more universal in the developed nations, but none are as robust, really, as ADA. ADA is really a model. Even the European equivalent is not as robust as ADA. Your earlier question about communities that do outside of Urbana-Champaign, I mean, really, the first law that included the architectural standards that that Tim actually did the seminal sort of work on to first develop were the universal access standards incorporated into the Rehab Act. But that was really only applicable to entities that received federal funding. And the ADA said, no, there's going to be this thing called public accommodation. And so it really applied those standards for access to the private sector. And that the ADA, that was really the sort of blessing of ADA, was that it meant that it wasn't just in these public venues or these areas where you receive that received federal funding that had to be accessible, but that really made the expanse of most communities and the businesses of those communities accessible. When I was in Carolina in the 70s, again, one of the greatest memories for me was I remember going with a friend of mine in a wheel who was in a wheelchair, and he had to back off everywhere. We had to help him everywhere. If he went shopping, he went downtown, he had to be popped up a curb and down a curb to get into a business which never had an accessible restroom or often inaccessible doorways. And I arrived here in 77, and I realized very quickly I could get in a wheelchair and traverse the entirety of the campus and off in the communities, go to Campus Town, go to Champaign, and remarkably accessible with curb cuts and buildings that were available and accessible. And that was extraordinary. And I think it's really a function of Tim's work here and the impact of the standards that were first developed here that have made their way systemically across this country and made the United States a model, really, for architectural access.
Yeah. Well, and just a footnote, I don't want to make it seem like the U.S. is perfect and there's nowhere else to grow, because there are places, somebody with a sensory impairment who can't see or hear can give you a list of things that they would love to change. My experience is as somebody who uses a wheelchair, and just 9 months ago I was up in Chicago, and I can tell you that not all of the train stops are accessible. Mm-hmm. And the train stops that have an elevator, the elevator doesn't always work. And so I had to crawl down about 23 stairs, I counted them, in order to get to another elevator that was going to take me up to the platform. Also, if you go to New England, there are a lot of buildings that are on the historical registry. Mm-hmm. And if a building is on that historical registry, it doesn't have to be accessible. And so when I go back to Boston, I still have to get picked up and carried into a lot of buildings. So I would rather live here than anywhere else, but there's definitely room to improve.
Yeah. Well, we have a couple minutes left. I just want to come back to something a little bit more that I also think is really interesting that you touched on. And when you talk about accessibility, I'm sure that, well, the first thing that people think about is accessibility of the built environment. Can you get into a building? But because the internet has become such an important general tool that people use just for virtually everything, but also because it's becoming increasingly important instructional tool, accessibility there is really important too, which is something I'm sure maybe people right first don't really think about. You know, is your website accessible? And that's something that you all have done a lot of work with too.
Right. We John Gunderson on our staff has developed the Illinois Center on Information Technology Accessibility. He's done some remarkable work. I mean, one of the first problems we had in the internet, I often would laugh with Tim and say, at least when you were out making the world accessible, you could one ramp at a time. You didn't wake up the next morning with exponentially more buildings to fix. But in the world of the web, that's not true. That you go out and if you use a repair model of I'll fix your site or your page, you wake up tomorrow with an exponentially greater problem. And so we really needed to get those standards developed quickly and then introduced and incorporated into the technologies that are used to build web content from the beginning, because a repair model was not going to work. We weren't going to be able to add ramps at the end. because the rate of growth is just is exponential. And so actually, John's done wonderful work in developing strategies that are interpretable and understandable to developers so that they can incorporate those. As a result of his work, Illinois really developed the first state law that really has the capacity to be implemented, the Illinois Information Technology Accessibility Act. And ultimately, through his work with the Big Ten, he did a national survey in the Big Ten, and is actually the strongest sort of conference nationally in the accessibility of its educational resources, and I think to a great degree through John's ICETA lab and its outreach. Mm.
Just one more thing. I wonder what sort of experiences now your students, when they graduate and they leave the university, as they go out into the world, particularly when it comes to their potential for employment, what sort of things are they're finding, and are they indeed continuing to find roadblocks, or is the willingness of employers to employ someone with a disability, is that getting better?
I think we've always had a very high rate of employment. Our students, we've gone back, we're unique also in the sense that we've done a lot of research on the employment outcome status of our students. We found that students with disabilities served by our unit have basically, over the course of their careers, had comparable pay and had similar career trajectories to their peers without disabilities when we've matched them by year of graduation and field of study. But we also have new populations. I mean, as we work more and more and facilitate success of individuals with some significant psychological disabilities, autism spectrum disabilities, I think we're yet to see how the degree is facilitating their career success. I mean, again, we're expanding that opportunity, but for a broadening population of people who were formerly marginalized, but we don't yet know what the impact of that's been.
Brad Hedrick is the director of the Division of Disability Resources and Education Services at the U of I. You can go to their website and find out more about them. Gene Driscoll is Associate Director of Development and Alumni Relations in the College of Applied Health Sciences here at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Thank you both very much for being here.
Well, thank
You're welcome.
You.
Thanks for having us.